Thank you very much for the opportunity to come. The people of this congregation have been important to me at various times and in ways that probably you don't know, and encouraging in various ways, and being able to attend the meetings here with you have all been good, and just nothing but good about this congregation, and I'm happy to be here. You know, maybe when you were growing up, you wondered some trivial things like, why are there mosquitoes? I hate when they bite me in the summer. Or, why are there tornadoes? I was always fascinated with the weather, and still am. Why are there tornadoes? Why are these things that are uncomfortable to us in our world? And maybe your parents said what my mom said, and she said, well, when you get to heaven, maybe you can ask God. And you know, that was good enough for me. It let her off the hook, so she didn't have to give me an answer. But maybe you've told your children that, or maybe you've asked your parents questions and received that kind of an answer. Well, I mean, now that you're older or getting older, what kind of question would you want to ask God if you were in His presence? I mean, I hope that all our questions will be irrelevant by the point when we're all in heaven. But I think I would want to ask the thing that so many people of the world ask when they doubt God. Why, for me, it's not this question, but for a lot of the people in the world, it's why is there suffering? Why is there difficulty in this world? Now, I think we have a pretty good answer to that. The book of James talks some about suffering. The book of Romans in chapter 5. The suffering makes us better people. And I think that's a good enough answer for me. But maybe what's more difficult for us as we go throughout life is, why am I suffering? Not just why am I suffering, that's going to happen. But why do I suffer these specific things? Why is it that some people can't seem to get a break from the difficulty? One family has a child taken away that they thought was going to be theirs. Then they have a very critical medical diagnosis. And it's when it rains, it pours. Why them? Why so many things? You know the people where if they're suffering a little, they're suffering a lot. And not just once, but all the time. One person is sick in the family time and again. The father loses the job and is unemployed for months, and they don't have insurance. They're living paycheck to paycheck because the wife is working and the kids are at home and grandma's taking care of them. Why do difficult situations like this happen? Or why do they happen to me or to the people I know? And why is it so difficult? Well, if you're human, I think sometimes you question whether or not you have a particular sin in your life and God is just kind of trying to wake you up and say, pay attention to me, trust in me. Or maybe you think that God has left you and that He's not taking care of your situation and that, well, this can't possibly be the answer to my prayer because that can't possibly be God's will because He only wants what's good for me. And these are very human thoughts, and I'm sure you've had them. Anybody I talk to has had at least one of those two thoughts. This can't possibly be God's will that I'm suffering this or that this particular thing happened to me. Well, I don't want to talk about exactly why they're suffering, but I want to look at two passages that to me are extremely encouraging in the face of any kind of suffering that we can go through. The first of those is in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. As you know, the Hebrews, I'm sorry, is this thing too close? I keep on making noise. Okay, whatever. As you know, the Hebrews were a group of Jewish Christians who were giving up on Christ. That was the risk. That's the whole purpose for why this book is written. Because these people were steadfast. There was a time when they were strong in the Lord, and when they had endured this first persecution, they had their possessions taken away from them. People were thrown in prison. And yet they endured through all of those sufferings. But now there's a threat of a second persecution. There is a division that's going throughout the Jewish community where these Christians aren't so welcome anymore. And so the question is, how are they reacting now? Well, as he says multiple times throughout the book, that, you know, we need to give the more earnest heed to these things, these important things about Jesus, in case we should drift away. And he goes at great lengths to get these Christians to see Jesus as just the absolute highest, first, most important thing, more than their Jewish religion ever was. He brings something to the table that is better than all of that. And so if the Spirit, through this author, can exalt Jesus to be so great and make Jesus so meaningful in the lives of all of these Christians, then I think the sentiment is, if Jesus is so wonderful and great and rewarding to the people of faith, then how could we ever let go of that? I think that's mainly the message of the book of Hebrews. One of the things used to try to get these Christians to persevere is to bring up the laundry list of examples, of Old Testament examples that they grew up knowing. These are examples from the Jewish scriptures, which Jews were raised on, hearing every Sabbath day and thinking about all the time. And so in chapter 11 and verse 4, starting with, well, no, you can back up to verse 3, because it doesn't even start with Abel, it starts with the formation of the world. That accepting the formation of our very world and universe is a matter of faith. And then he goes with Abel and goes all throughout these Old Testament examples chronologically. And so the point of that is, well, I'm familiar with all these characters of faith. So if they did it, I can too. That's what he's trying to get his readers to understand. But there's not enough time to go through all of those examples. Because when you get to verse 30, he just starts listing off all the kinds of things that happen to people of faith without going through names and specific ones. And you just see this pile of evidence of people who've suffered worse than they had and persevered anyway. But he's still not done. He's still not done, because when he gets to chapter 12, he starts painting a picture for them that he says he's picturing this race that the Hebrew Christians are in, that all Christians are in. And in this race, they're in an arena where they can look around and see. It says that we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and he's talking about all those people from chapter 11. So as you're running your race and you're thinking about giving up, well, you look up there and there's Abel and there's Moses, who made it out of Egypt, and the faithful ones with him. And there was Abraham, who went to great lengths to serve God, even to the point of putting the knife nearly in his son. All these people who went to such a great length to serve God, you look and see them all around. You're surrounded by these witnesses. If you want to know how to escape sexual temptation, there's Joseph to show you. If you want to know what it's like when your brothers turn against you, there's Abel. Whatever is encumbering you in this race, the witnesses are there to show you how to persevere. But not just them. Not just those examples. But he goes on and says in verse 1, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of God. Yeah, we're surrounded by witnesses. But he said, look to Jesus, to the author, the perfecter of faith, the one who did everything absolutely right and shows us how to do absolutely everything right. And he should know. He's the author of all of these things. Look at him and consider what he suffered while he was on this earth. That he endured the cross, and there was shame attached to the cross. And that was not a pleasant experience for him or for his disciples. But he said this, that he didn't just say that, and look to Jesus who endured the cross and despised the shame, but he says how he got through it. He said, for the joy that was set before him. If you've completed a race or a competition of any kind, there's a medal at the end, there's a, you know, you get a maybe a cool hat to wear or a t-shirt for participating. In band, we got little medals for making it so far in state competition and all of that. There's a certain joy that's set before musicians and runners and people who ride bikes, bicyclists, I guess. And we understand on a very small level what it's like to have this joy set before them. But we can raise the bar a little bit more than that. We've all seen the movie, or the movies, or the shows, and every one of them is the same, where the hero or the heroine gets stabbed, and they're bleeding out their side, and they're like lying on the ground, throwing up, and nearly passing out. But for the love of this woman or this man, they find it in themselves to just reach and like press the button that solves all the problems or calls the person who's going to rescue everybody. Well, and we think, oh, those are such nice stories. And, you know, because he loved her and he was able to get through all of it, the biggest difficulty. It's part of all our great stories. It's not just, he loved a woman, and he went over to her door, and they had a happily ever after. There's always some difficulty in the story that you have to get through. All our great stories, all our great fairy tales, you know, the knight has to, or Prince Charming or whoever, has to make it through all of the thicket of briar that is surrounding the castle, and they have to go through in the fire-breathing dragon, and you know, it's this daunting thing, and then it's Sleeping Beauty at the end. But he was brave enough to get through it because she's just the most gorgeous or whatever kind of most powerful princess ever, and he's able to make it through. Well, for the joy that was set before Jesus, he endured the cross and all the shame that went along with it. And I just want to mention this, that the word despising doesn't always mean, I hate this. We use it often that way, if you despise a person. But the word despising, as it's used in the Bible, doesn't always mean that you just hate the experience or hate the person. It often means that you just think nothing of it, or that you just kind of disregard it in your mind. And so seeing Jesus in that way, he endured the cross and thought nothing of the shame. He didn't let the shame stop him from accomplishing what he needed to reach that joy and endure the cross. And he ended up, after he suffered, as Peter says often in his book, that after he suffered, he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And if we consider him in verse 3, as we're looking at our suffering, if we consider Jesus, it says he endured such hostility from sinners against himself. And he says, if you consider this, you need to consider it, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls, for you have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Jesus paid the full price. He went all the way, even to the point of death. But none of us have suffered that bad. And if Jesus can make it through even all the way to death, we don't have that far to go. And are we going to give up in the middle of this? For the Hebrews, they'd only been put in prison and had their things confiscated in chapter 10. No one's died yet for their faith in this group of people. So Jesus ought to be a huge encouragement to them because of how much he suffered. They can make it through. But in verse 5, he continues on to say, "You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons." Okay, so this exhortation is going to pertain directly to the matter of giving up during your suffering, this risk they were running. He says, "My son, do not despise the discipline of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives." If they can remember that, they can keep going. If we can remember not to despise the discipline of the Lord, whether to disregard it or to hate the discipline of the Lord, if we can learn not to do that, we can make it through our trial. Why does he have to say, "Do not despise the chastening of the Lord," or the discipline? Because we all know what it's like when we were younger and we said something that was out of line, and our parents... I had this more than once. My dad reached down and he smacked my mouth. And I don't know about you, but tooth pain is the worst to me. I'd rather be spanked 1,000 times than be hit in the mouth. And it would make me angry, right? As a child, to be hit, and I'm sure your children have all kind of stomped off and pouted and everything because dad hit me or whatever. It's not pleasant. It's so easy for us to say, because once we get punished, once we get corrected and are going the right way, boy, if we do something wrong, we're never going to fess up to that, because then we're going to get punished some more. And we hate punishment. That's just the way we are. We don't like it. But he says, but what he's trying to do is to get us before our suffering and through our difficulty to already, as we're going through it, not to despise the chastening of the Lord. It's easy afterward, when we're an adult, to say, "I'm glad my parents set me straight on these things, because I'm a better person for it." I'm only saying that years later. But during the suffering, I didn't appreciate the discipline of my parents. And so here, it's easy after you've become a more holy person to say, "I'm so glad I went through this trial." It's only easy to say that after the fact. It's never easy going through. But what he's trying to, you know, the people who, as they're going through a trial, they just grumble about it the whole time and make it worse and worse for themselves and all the people who are trying to support them. Because that's so easy to do. It's so easy to grumble and to say, "I don't know where I'm going through this. It's just one thing on top of another. And doesn't life ever let up?" And if we never say those things, at least we have thought them one time or another. But afterward, when the person has been made holy, more holy by this, then they look back and say, I see the reason why now. Well, what the Spirit is trying to get us to understand is that while you don't understand the reason why, appreciate the chastening, the discipline now, while you're going through the suffering, when you haven't even seen the result yet, because there is a promised result, because we will be more holy and righteous people after we've endured, made it through to the end. So have this attitude now of not grumbling and despising the Lord's discipline, because he's teaching us for what is right. And not only that, in verse 7, he says, "If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. For we've had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but God for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. When we're in heaven and all of these things have passed away, we're sure going to appreciate the discipline of the Lord. And with our eye of faith, seeing what he is making us into, that should allow us to take a different view of what I'm going through right now, of what my friend is going through right now, because we are being made to be partakers of his holiness. No chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. And because of this, because it yields righteousness, right into verse 12, because it yields righteousness, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Since you can be holy and righteous and partake of all those great things, the people who are discouraged and who are walking down like this, help them spiritually. Help them up. The hands that hang down because they just don't have the energy, hold those up. And how he says, and the feeble knees make straight paths so that what is lame may not be dislocated. If you don't treat a dislocated finger or joint, it's going to heal the wrong way. So heal all of these things. Make these things right so that you can be healed and that it won't be lame and profitless, unprofitable. It's interesting as he goes along, encouraging these people to keep on going, that he makes a comparison to Esau. We all know Esau. He's the one who was too hungry, and so he sold his birthright. I mean, really, it was Jacob taking advantage of him, taking Esau's birthright, caught him in a weak moment. Like suffering tends to do, catches us when we are weak and the temptations are easy to give into. And so Esau sold his birthright for one morsel of food in verse 16. So in verse 15, you need to look carefully lest anyone should fall short. In verse 16, look carefully lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. This is a sad story, because he goes on to say, for you know that afterward, when Esau wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. You know people who've cried in hopeless situations? Esau, he gave up his birthright, and he had no clue what was going to come through that birthright and through that blessing. All of the promises, the Messiah himself. And in a moment, he gave all of that up because he was short-sighted. All he saw was, I'm going to die if I don't get food, and I'm going to sell my birthright. And he never knew or never could have known in that moment, I'm selling the promises and the Messiah, and that's going to be Jacob's. And he characterizes Esau as a fornicator. Not because he was, but just this characterization of the kind of sin that he committed. And in what way is Esau's action like a fornicator? Well, he was very short-sighted. He was thinking about pleasure now, without thinking of the consequence that was coming after that. And that's often what fornication does. It gives you pleasure now, but it reaps a world of hurt afterward. So, Christians who are suffering, he says, don't be like Esau. Don't be like a fornicator. Don't quit in the middle of your suffering, because, you know, for the Hebrews, if they would just quit on Christ, they could be accepted by all of their Jewish family again. They could be accepted by the community around them and wouldn't be thrown in prison or have their things taken away. And that would be pleasurable for the moment. But if they would endure, they could be partakers of holiness. So the encouragement for them is not to sell their birthright in a moment of weakness. The encouragement for us is don't give up on Christ in a moment of trial, because the Lord is teaching us something great. So two things I want to draw from this, and then we'll go to the other passage, is that clearly for the Hebrews, they're suffering persecution, and it's clear that God is not causing them to be persecuted. He's not persecuting his own cause. A broader point would be that God is not the cause of all our suffering. It's not that he killed grandma, killed the children in someone's womb. It's not that he made you lose your job necessarily, or inflicted your life with pain. Some of that is time and chance. Some of that maybe is that you're sinful and he's trying to get your attention by allowing bad things to happen to you. But God is not the cause of all difficulty, but he is the teacher in all difficulty. Whatever you are suffering, he is teaching you something. It's like a parent who decides to teach their child, I don't know, for me it was math. I didn't like math. Okay. Let's do hammering a nail. We're all familiar with hammering a nail, I hope. Oh, no. Head's shaking. That's great. So when you're hammering a nail, you have about zero accuracy when you start out. You hit all the shingles around you or the piece of wood, and this nail, this tiny little head, and you all know what happens when you're hitting that nail. And you smack your thumb, and you get so upset. But what your parent does is they say, okay, well, actually, what you ought to do is you try to hold the thing down here, take a smaller stroke, and they try to help you through this learning curve of, you know, hammering a nail. We need to teach you how to hammer a nail. So that's the situation the parent created. They decided, I'm going to teach you how to hammer a nail. That's what we're doing. But there are also other situations where you've gone to school and you're having a conflict with someone else in the classroom. Your parent didn't create that situation, but when you bring that home to them, they are more than willing to sit down with you and help you understand the way people work and how you can handle this conflict. Parents cause difficult things for their kids, but they also take the things that are naturally difficult for their children and teach them. Same way with us. Whether God has caused a difficulty or just one just exists in our lives, he is the teacher. He is there to show us how to be holy. And the second part, difficulty is not necessarily an indication of how sinful you are. It's easy to view it that way. Well, if suffering is going to make me more holy, then more suffering means that I am just so far from holiness. And you can put it that way. Most people put it, I'm just so sinful, and that's why I'm suffering so much. But I think another way we could look at this is that these people for whom when it rains, it pours difficulty on them. It could also be that God is indicating that you have so much potential, and this suffering is going to help you reach this height that you never knew you could go without this suffering. It's like when you get promoted to be an executive in a company. It's not just you're moving that much in the company and now you're an executive. Usually it's a much bigger leap than that. You go through lots of training, lots of classes, tons of meetings with people to get you in the mode to be the CFO or the superintendent or whatever you are. There's a great learning curve and a lot of training that needs to go into it. And it could be that on your way to becoming a more holy person, God has looked at you and said, you have so much potential, and it is going to be difficult with all of these sufferings, but you are going to have so much strength on the other side. For those people who suffer so much, it is an indication of how much more holy you can be. And I think if you see the people who are older, who have gone through awful things in their lives, you'll see that to be true. If you turn over to John 9, the disciples there had a similar question to one that we often have. Am I suffering because I'm a sinner? In John 9 and verse 1, it says, "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, so that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is the day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." You know the story that when he goes on, he spits on the ground and he makes little clay mud. He puts it on the man's eyes and in verse 7 tells him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. So he goes and does that and comes back seeing. And the religious authorities are not thrilled with this. They bring in the man who used to be blind. They brought in his parents, and they're interrogating about this. And at the end of the chapter, we see all of them together where Jesus talks to both the blind man and these religious people who aren't pleased, the Pharisees. But let's stay here in the first part of the story for now. Since we know that this man becomes a seeing man, the question is, how does he get from being blind to seeing? And why is it that he was blind in the first place? We get a very unusual answer from Jesus. He says, well, I think it's right, you know, he says that neither this man nor his parents sinned. But he doesn't just leave it at that. He doesn't say, because God said so, or just because that, hey, that's the way God made him, and everybody has their cross that they have to bear in life. He puts a spin on this that is just so profound in its meaning. It says in verse 3, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. So this man was born blind, and he had been blind from birth. We don't know how old he was. But however long it was, he had been blind since birth. And Jesus said the whole reason for this was so that I could show God's works in him. The reason for this man's suffering. Imagine how difficult it was all of those years being blind and an outcast and not highly respected like the other men, having to be taken care of by your parents and your friends and to find your way places or be guided by the arm. All that difficulty, years and years of difficulty, not for no reason, but just so that the works of God could be shown in him. The man had no power in himself to make himself see. The power was in God alone. and Jesus came and bestowed that power on him. And so it was obvious to everybody around, hey, that, you know, you see these ads in the internet, you know, Bloomington mom makes doctors outrageous because she found the perfect skin solution. It's not one of those where he just found the magic ointment, put it on his eyes, and now he can see, and everybody's furious, and the doctors. It was absolutely certain. No man is able to do this. And so you see the work of God highlighted. And in another passage, in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul's talking about a difficulty that he experienced. It was a near-death experience. And he says in verse 8, 2 Corinthians 1, verse 8, "For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened beyond measure and above strength, so that we despaired even of life. Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in God, we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he will still deliver us." Why? Why did Paul have this near-death experience? Why was it totally beyond his power to control, like he says, above power, burdened beyond measure? That's more than his fair share. They despaired. They even reached a point of despair in seeing their life in danger. "And we had the sentence of death in ourselves," verse 9, "so that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead." Isn't that so similar to the blind man passage? That he suffered all those years so the works of God could be shown in him. And then here, humans are made powerless to save their own lives so that it could be ascribed to God for saving their lives and for resurrecting them at the end. Oftentimes when we suffer, I know what we do when we get a life-threatening diagnosis, or when we lose our jobs, or we have children that for some reason or another we just suddenly can't take care of on our own for a while. When things are above our power, we go in to get the best doctor, we get the best lawyer, the best babysitter, the best recruiter, so I can get that job and it can solve my problem. But we've all known that the best doctors still have casualties. They have people who don't make it or who never recover. The best recruiters sometimes don't find the job. The best lawyer still doesn't win the case. And so what are we to make of all that? Take a lesson from Paul, that we were burdened beyond measure. It was above our power, above our ability to do. And I think this is exactly the moment where Paul highlights the working of God. When it's above your strength, Paul highlights God's work and his ability. And so after, you know, we've gotten used to making our own way in the world, we study, we work, we get paid, we take care of things. And after all of that self-reliance, it's hard for us to let go of that power, to admit, I can't do it. I can't do it by myself. But this helplessness ends up making us desperate for God, so that when our efforts seem to fail, it should be a strong clue to us that the solution to our problem is not going to come through us. It's going to come through our faith in the one who raises the dead, the one who moves the hands and the minds of kings, the one who even takes care of the sparrow and the grass. He's the one who will solve our problem. If we have been made powerless in our sufferings and we can't solve our problem, any good result is clearly going to be God. It's like the blind man. It's like Paul and his companions. the good result is going to obviously be God and not us. Not because we had the best doctor, the cleverest lawyer, the most intelligent recruiters on our side. It's not the God who only rules in the kingdoms of men. He rules in the courtrooms, he rules in the OR, and in the interview rooms, he rules in your home, and in your own private bedroom. That's where he rules and he acts for the people who have put their faith in him. So for these people who suffer often, or when you ask yourself, why am I suffering? What if you saw your life like, I'm sure if we had the opportunity, I would love for Jesus to come and ask me if I would suffer for him. If he said, David, you're going to have to endure some really hard things. Why? Why am I going to have that? To have that? And then if he said back to me or to you, so that the work of God could be shown through you, so that something that would be so obvious a good result that it's beyond human power, it must be God, that kind of thing could be shown in your life through your suffering, who would say no to that? Who could say no to that? But what he's done for us is he's, just like in the Hebrews passage, we're trying to get, before the suffering, we're trying to get to the point where we appreciate the discipline of the Lord and don't grumble against it. Well, here too, before we go through a suffering where it is just above our strength and we're to the point of despair, it's trying to get us to back up and say, before that even happens, we recognize that when it is beyond our power, it is the work of God that is going to work this out. It's not going to be my own cleverness. It's going to be God. It's an abundant opportunity for God to show his work through you. The greater your suffering ends up resulting in greater desperation for God. And anything that moves your faith up the ladder seems to be fair game, I guess. Whatever will move your faith up. But it only works if we view our suffering that way. It's not necessarily that we're just so sinful and that's why, you know, suffering is raining down on us. Maybe it's that we have the greatest potential. Or we didn't know, we didn't realize what kind of potential we had. It's that when I'm suffering, God wants me to learn something from it. He wants me to be more holy. And when I'm suffering, he wants me to give up on myself. Give up on feeling so confident that I can do and fix everything. At the end of the story of the blind man, turn over to John 9. We'll read the end of the story. After the interrogation, the man comes back and he's looking for Jesus. And when he's talking to Jesus, at the end in verse 35, they had cast out this blind man, and when Jesus had found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." This is obviously a metaphor. He did make a blind man to see, but what he's doing is he's making a spiritual comparison here. And the Pharisees catch on to this. They say, and some of the Pharisees who were with him, in verse 40, heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see,' therefore your sin remains." They were not accepting Jesus, not like the blind man did when he fell down and worshiped before him, when clearly the work of God had been displayed right in front of him. Well, we all face and have faced a powerless situation. It's not that I was born blind and now I can see. Any of the sufferings here that we face are not worthy to be compared of the greatest despair and the greatest suffering that someone can face, to be without God. The ultimate powerless situation, where we can't build a Tower of Babel to go up to heaven, we can't climb on the stairs in the presence of Jacob that the angels were going up and down. We can't get there ourselves. So any means by which we can get there is going to be of God. Do you see how that compares to our earthly suffering, our earthly powerlessness? The work is of God and not of ourselves. If you'd open your songbook to number 818, I am resolved. You remember the comparison about Esau? Suffering tends to make us give up on our hopes, on anything long term. We want the pleasure right now. But it says in verse 1, I am resolved no longer to linger, charmed by the world's delight, things that are higher, things that are nobler, these have allured my sight. That's the joy set before us that we're enduring all this suffering for. That's the joy. We're determined, we're resolved to follow the Savior that's fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. But what's so hard for us is leaving the paths of sin and the opposition that we face, just like the Hebrews. In verse 3, leaving the paths of sin, friends may oppose me, foes may beset me, still I will enter in. That kind of determination and faith in the Son of God and every wonderful thing that He's done for us, we will enter in, not by our working, but by His. And we will praise Him forever. Let's stand and sing.